How is everybody? Doing all right? Okay, not too convincing. All right, everybody okay? Okay, just making sure. Well, here's what we're going to be in today. We're going to be back in the book of 1 Peter. If you haven't been here in a little while, we had finished up the book of Revelation, and out of the book of Revelation, one of the words that I kept seeing over and over again that I thought, oh man, it would be a great thing to be able to do a series on is this idea of testimony or this idea of witness. And so what we're doing is we're doing a series that's called, Can I Get a Witness? And so really this is what we're going to be looking at is this idea of specifically is how does the church witness to Jesus Christ in the world? I think one of the key aspects I think that drew me to it when we were studying the book of Revelation is the identity of true followers of Jesus Christ. The way that we'll know them and see them and understand them is that they will be these witnesses. They will be this testimony. And if you even study the book of Acts, the one thing that stuck out about the church is the constant testimony and witness of the church. And so if we are going to be, I think, the church that Jesus Christ has called us to be, then that means we're a church that's to be testifying, that we're to be witnessing, we're to be these witnesses. And I think that Jesus Christ, through this series, I hope what he calls out amongst us as a church at Cornerstone and ask that question, can I get a witness? And we step forward and we say, here we are. And so this is really where we're going to be, that word testimony or witness. One of the reasons I love that word is it comes from the Greek word martyria, which means martyr. If you've ever wondered where we get the term martyr from, that's where we get the term martyr from. And I think the church for years and years has demonstrated our love and our care for people by being willing to die for others so that they might know Jesus. But here's the thing I've been asking in my own mind. I think sometimes we will agree that, you know what, I will die for Jesus. But the more interesting question is, will you live for him? Isn't that interesting? Just flip it around a little bit. Everybody always thinks the most grand thing that you can do is die for Jesus. But I'll tell you what, I think it's just as impactful for us to live for him. And so that's really what we're looking at when we get to the book of 1 Peter. We're trying to understand and be captivated by him. And the verse that we're using to guide us is found in 1 Peter 3:15, where Peter writes this. He says, look, but set apart Christ as Lord in your hearts. So that's the first part of it. And always being ready to give an answer to anyone who asks about the hope that you possess. So we as a church, what I want for us is to be this church that has an answer this for this hope that the people see in this. But I think it begins way back when you look up there in this idea of setting apart Christ as Lord. So the focus of week one, that's what we did, is that in order to be able to give an effective answer to witness well, I think we first have to wrestle with what does it mean to set apart Christ as Lord in our hearts. So we looked at that and we talked about the fact that the first aspect of it is I not only need to be enraptured with who Christ is, but I need to be captured by who he is. I need to be that one that first understand how to bend his knee in front of this great Jesus before I can ever be one to communicate who he is. The next week, and I loved Chris's presentation of just this idea of the process of Jesus gaining lordship. I didn't expect him, well, he did on Thursday, this idea of ice cream, but who would have ever thought that Chris has such a problem with ice cream? So I felt better. I didn't have to gossip about him because he already told us, so I was thankful of that. But I think the key part about it is that once we have tasted and seen that the Lord is good, once we've truly seen him for who he is, man, I'll tell you what, even in the messy process, we will give up anything to follow him. And then last week, when Christian opened it up, one of the things he wanted us to understand is that this isn't just an individual reality. It's not just something we do on our own. But God is building this temple of people that are his to exercise his collective lordship over them in such a way that the excellencies of him might now be communicated out of darkness into this marvelous light so that, and I love the way he finished, so that we might become these priests, these go-betweens from God to people, that we are designed for something so much, I think, bigger than we even understand. And so that's where we've been going. We've been trying to lay this out at its core, this process of lordship that Jesus is trying to bring about in our life. It's messy. It gets frustrating at times. But through that process, that messy process, not only individually but collectively, God is telling the world something about who he is. Now, the message that I think that we're going to share, and we're going to start getting into it, concerns these amazing promises, and they do need to be vocalized. But it begins, again, like I want to start, go back to this. It begins with this idea of him claiming lordship. He's after our fear. He's after our affections. He's the king that to be acknowledged in obedience, but I think he's also to be learned to be adored and delighted in. There was a guy named Abraham Kuyper in the 18th and 19th century, and I think Peter had a lot of this idea when he's saying, and I love this quote. He says, "There's not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine." Everything. When we ask the question, what's Christ after in his lordship? He's after everything. So it begins, though, when we talk about this in our particular lives. Christ first is after us. This is the very idea of the letter. It's what Paul, though, wrote. And last week, Christian started to kind of go down this path when he was talking about how this mind starts to be part of our lives. He says, "Beloved, I urge you," verse 11, "to, as sojourners and exiles, to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul." We may not realize it, but every single day there is a battle that goes on with us between this world and its system that's headed by Satan and God and his good kingdom. And the passions of our flesh are going after one, and it's waging against our soul, he says. And there, in this battle now, we're finding out who it is that's truly Lord of our lives. He says in there, and I love the way he put it, abstain from it. Stay away from those things that wage war against your soul. Now, I think in our thinking, what we tend to do when we get there is so therefore, I need to not drink, I don't need to smoke, I don't need to chew, I don't need to date girls that do. I need to stay away from all those particular things. That's what he's talking about. But I think he has something that is so bigger in mind than just staying away from things. I think he's arguing for this idea that there's a purpose, which verse 12 comes in, which is to keep your conduct among Gentiles honorable. Why, Peter? So that when they speak of you as evildoers, they may see your good days, deeds, and glorify God on the day of visitation. See, the concept that he's trying to say is that, look, people are going to get frustrated with you. People are going to get frustrated that you don't live in line with the world and its system. And he even talks about this idea. They'll see you even at this point where you're evildoers. But the good deeds that come from Christ becoming Lord of our lives cause others, look at that up there, to now glorify God, and here's the key, on the day of visitation. Now, the word day of visitation could mean when Jesus Christ returns, no doubt about it, that somehow God's people are going to live these lives that proclaim to the world so that when Jesus Christ comes back, people are held without excuse. But probably more the idea is this day of visitation is that as the church is the church to culture, in a very powerful way, Christ visits the world through his church. He's arguing this, that the reason we want lordship in our lives and we want transformation to happen is not just to get clean while we bide our time until Jesus Christ returns, but we want his lordship in our lives so that as God gains lordship in us, we begin to be this group of people now that are the ones whom Christ visits this world through. You all, as followers of Jesus, are the ones now who Jesus visits the world through. We want now to be transformed and to make different. And that's the concept of the idea he's getting after. We're introducing and testifying to the world about the person of Jesus. How we live as a church tells something about it. Now, that's important. Because last week is we weren't meant to create a sub-world. We're not supposed to now go create these worlds to go live in that make us comfortable. We're not supposed to go back into the world in this system. Instead, here's the key. We're to live as the church in our culture. What does he mean by that? I think sometimes we forget who we are. We don't mean to. But as I look out over this group of people, this is who you are. You are the church. You are these ones set apart by God that were purchased, according to 1 Peter 1:18 through 19, and ransomed by Jesus Christ to not just be anybody, but to be now this group of people that he talks about in 2:9 that are his distinct people. Paul says that you're not just any group of people. You are sons and daughters of the King. You are his prized possession. You are the ones that he sent his son to die for, to redeem, to set apart, to make his very own. And one day, all of you out here that are followers of Jesus Christ, Jesus is coming back to claim you, and you will live forever in his presence and his glory and his goodness, forever and ever and ever. That is who you are. Now, Peter says, be that. Act like who you are. The reason we abstain from that is not because, again, we're just trying to stay away from it because somehow evil kills. We're staying away from it because we want to be the people that God has designed us to be. He was trying to create a contrast, man, in this world that's ruled by Satan, that is this system that constantly now is plaguing people over and over again. He's creating this system now for this people that he loves. It's the Romans 6 idea. There's a difference between the two of them. This world and its system has been the weight that's been bearing on people for years and years and years that appeals to our flesh, and it's a burdensome reality, and it's a tiring reality. And I think that's why in Matthew 11, Jesus said, look, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn from me. I'm gentle and lowly in heart, and I'll find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, my burden's light. One yoke is hard and burdensome. The other, he says, and there is life and goodness. And I think this is crucial in understanding not only Peter's argument, but more importantly, how God intends for us to be witnesses. So how do we do this? Well, open your Bibles up to 1 Peter 2, and we're going to kind of talk about this, about, okay, so how are we going to be these witnesses today? And what he's going to do is he's going to grab three areas of life that kind of affected the church. Now, he could have grabbed any areas of life. He could have grabbed multiple, but he's going to talk about government. So you ready today? Guess what we're going to talk about? Government. Sounds exciting, doesn't it? We're going to talk also about vocation. Peter's going to land this reality into our vocation. And the third one he's going to land it into is marriage. Now, the reason that I think he could totally expand this more is he's, again, trying to create a contrast. I believe that Jesus wants his glory to be seen, and so therefore he's going to land it into every facet of life. Now, here's what he says to us today in this idea of how it is that Jesus is going to visit the world through his church. He says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Now, here's the first word that we're going to look at that I think is key to where we're going. If we're going to be this group of people that display Jesus, or that Jesus visits his church in such a way to do this, I think the word is up there, which is this term, be subject. Now, when I say that term, real quickly, what goes through your head? Be subject. If you're anything like me, I am repulsed by that word. I hate the idea of being subject. Another way that this word is sometimes seen is the idea of submission. At Peter's time, what this word meant, now just wrap your mind around this. In order for us to be the church that Christ visits this world through, it meant to lose, which could be this idea of unintentional, or it meant to surrender, which is the idea of intentional, one's own rights to another willingly. I want you, he says, to willingly or unwillingly, intentionally or unintentionally, lose your rights to people intentionally. Now, some of you are like, I bet there's a caveat here. I like caveats because then it keeps me from getting frustrated with Todd right now. It's a slippery word, man. It's a slippery word because I think we want to redefine it away from this idea of intentionally giving up our rights. But I would say it's a word that's fundamental to us being Jesus to the world that we live in. And we struggle in it partly, I think, because we live in the United States of America. We are subject to no one. My wife had the audacity yesterday. Audacity, people, to watch the royal wedding. Stupid Brits. Kings and queens, we're subject to no one. My wife must be a communist now. Thank you. I'll have you talk to my wife after service. Now, some people have chosen to translate this word so that we can get out of it a little bit as deference or like respect. That really what he's saying here is that the church is to be, have deference or respect, but I think this completely dilutes the word that's being used here. The command, I don't think, was merely that we're supposed to respect those that rule over us, but we would willfully surrender our own rights to them is the idea that Peter's arguing. There's no doubt that I think deference would be here. I think respect would be here. And definitely a huge aspect of this. But I think the larger idea is found in maybe this term. Are you ready for this term? Obey. The term obey, you'll see this like in 1 Peter 3, 5 through 6, where we'll get to it in a couple weeks. And I'm letting Chris do this because I'm afraid to. Where we talk about husbands and wives. He moves from this idea in verse 5 of subjection or submission to this idea of obedience in verse 6. He saw them as like intimately connected, so that the way that we see this concept playing out in 2:13 is not only that we would be in subjection, but that we would be in obedience to those that rule over us. He saw them as intimately connected, and this is where we rebel. Now, I don't think it's just an American thing, right? Because I think when you go back to the Garden of Eden, the reason that Adam and Eve fell, they fell because they didn't want to be in subjection under God. They didn't want to be in submission. And the moment that they sinned, it sprung all of humanity into this rebellion and non-submission. It's a part of who we are as humanity. It was at the heart of, I think, why he wanted people to set apart Christ as Lord in their hearts. He was inviting them when he said, I want you to set apart Christ as Lord in your hearts, is I want you to regain what was lost in the garden. I want you to join and have that submission that God designed you to have, to submit yourself fully to King Jesus as Lord. He was trying to create the contrast between people that somehow think that they're ruled by nothing, even though Romans 6 says that we're enslaved to our sin. And instead of being enslaved to our sin, you'll see this in verse 17, to enslave yourself to, or verse 16, excuse me, enslave yourself to God because you are designed to live in submission to the King. Now, to be honest, when you look down there, to live in submission, I think for most people, you see that last word up there? Frightening. The idea of living in submission is frightening. Why? Because I think when we talk about submission, it's limitless. See that word for the Lord's sake? When he says be subject for the Lord's sake, he's saying that to be in submission has this limitless idea to him. Not to government, but we're going to talk about this more, to him. We're afraid somehow, I think in the back of our head, if I submit in that kind of a way, that I'm going to be somehow the one that loses control, and we hate to lose control. I'm going to in some way be taken advantage of, and I don't like to be taken advantage of. We don't want to be marginalized and lonely. We don't want to be seen as lesser. But in a powerful way, when he throws out this idea of subjection, this is exactly what he's calling us to. He's calling us, Matthew 11, to learn what it's like to have the yoke of Jesus on us, to fully accept his lordship in our lives. Submit to him. It becomes a huge, I think, tall order. And then he says, not only now out of my submission, he says, I want you now to play this out into every fabric of society. But I think what the very thing that we miss in this, though, is on one end of it, this is what he's called us as Christians to be, is submissive. But I think this is really where we start to find hope. Notice that this submission, and I love this, is for the Lord's sake. It's according to the Lord. The submission that I think he has in mind, that the Holy Spirit is trying to lay upon us, is that it's the foundation of what he's talking about. And there's going to be two things that are going to become key to how Jesus visits this world through the church, which is one, this idea of being subject for the Lord's sake, I think means that Jesus is our example, which we're going to look at first. And I think the other part of it is it shows how this submission has parameters. Let's start with the first. Next week, we're going to learn this in a greater way, but Peter makes the idea crystal clear in 2:21 when he says, "For to this," and he's referencing submission, look at this, "you've been called." Just let that settle for a second. You've been called to submission. No, Todd, no. You understand who I am. I submit to no one. I'm the captain of my ship. Just ask any graduation speaker. We just have this wrong idea and miss this, that actually, no, for this you have been called because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might, look at this, follow in his steps. Jesus was Peter's constant frame of reference for everything that he lays out. In the Gospels, we learn that Jesus submitted to his parents. We learn that he submitted to the religious leaders. In regards to government, he submitted to the government where he lived. And ultimately, he did that because of first having this idea of a submission to his Father. He submitted, and then maybe this we can put it a different way. He submitted according to the Father. He said, "I came and I came to do the will of my Father." And this submission, the point is, it's to go all the way to death, and even death as an unjust criminal upon the cross. Peter clarified it later in 2:23. He said, look, this is what it's supposed to look like for us as Christians. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to the one who judges justly. This is the model we're called to follow. Who wants to follow Jesus? No, I kind of like complaining about government more than I like actually submitting to it. But this was his life. Now, the key from Philippians 2 that I think is huge here is that Jesus was humble. I don't think it's just that we're scared to submit. There's one side of it where I don't want to lose control. But I think the reason that we buck others having authority over us is we are just flat out prideful. I don't want the idea of anybody over me. But the beauty of what it is that Jesus, in his submission from 2:5 and following all down to 8, we see that he was willing to die this death, even death on a cross. But then in chapter 2, verse 9, he starts saying, "But God exalted him high above everything so that the name of Jesus, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord." Now for us, let's see how Peter lays this out. He says, look, clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility. Sounds familiar in Philippians 2. Towards one another. Well, why? Because God opposes the proud. Why does he oppose the proud? Because that's not who his son was. But now, who does he give grace to? Well, to the humble. So therefore, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. Why? Well, just like Philippians 2, at the proper time, he may exalt you, he may honor you. And I love this, but what if I'm fearful? Then you just cast all of your anxieties on him because he cares for you. The humbling of ourselves and the submission of ourselves is following the pattern of Jesus. And the beauty of following the pattern of Jesus is that there will come a time, whether now or later, in which I would rather have the honor of God than I would anyone else. Peter says it's worth it to do this. Now, I think there's this other side of it when you wrestle through it that we kind of go, okay, but aren't there limits? Isn't there a limit to this? Shouldn't there be something in which there's a bottom to which we can understand on this? I think it does, and I think that's why he throws out this idea of a human institution. He's trying to say, look, of all, this is your model. This is what it looks like for Jesus to visit the world. You're going to live in submission to those over you. But then there's this other side of it, to be for now the sake of the Lord, is that there's now an eight limit to it. And why does this word institution matter? That word institution, literally what it means is it means creation. That means that within our society, kings, rulers, presidents, bosses, pastors, they're just merely creatures. The one that matters is God. So Peter is saying to them, look, at the end of the day, if anyone above you that's placed above you by God asks you to go contrary to who God is, then you say the answer is no. Okay, so what does that mean? There's limits. This means that when the government permits the degradation of people based on the color of their skin to unjust labor or ill treatment, slavery, the Jim Crow laws, like in early America, we must refuse to submit because they are to be honored with dignity. When a race of people is being exterminated by government, like in Germany, we must refuse to obey because those being murdered are created in the image of God. When infants are being seen as merely a part of a woman's body that can be eliminated like a gallbladder, like in our time, we must stand against it because to slaughter those whom God has called my own image bearers is absolutely wrong. But listen to me. Anywhere that God does not see something as evil, we are to submit. Anywhere. Anywhere. Well, but Todd, let's take for example Barack Obama. I don't know if I can submit to him. Well, I love what he does in there because he's going to connect it to this idea, whether it be to the emperor. The emperor at this particular time, or the word we might more commonly know it as, was Caesar. The guy that was the Caesar at this particular time in the world was a man named Nero Claudius Caesar. You might have heard of him. He is in most top 10 lists of the most awful people that have ever walked the planet. He was the leader of Rome when Peter penned this letter. He was born in AD 37. Nero was educated at the feet of a guy named Seneca, which was one of the biggest philosophers of all time. Now, this guy, Nero, was so bad that the guy that mentored him and trained him, eventually one day he made commit suicide. He murdered his way to the imperial throne, and that's where he served from 54 to 68 AD. His life was characterized by debauchery, decadence, and violence. He even had his own mom killed. In AD 64, though, a terrible fire broke out in Rome. It was strongly believed that Nero, he deliberately set the fire, and in setting the fire, he did it to justify building a more grand, glorious Rome. The infernal raged out of control for more than a week, and 70% of the city was destroyed by fire. As a consequence of this tragedy, and I think just the widespread belief that Nero did this thing on purpose, which from what we can tell, he probably did, he began to bear huge amounts of intense criticism. But Nero, being the wise, evil, awful man that he is, came up with a plan. Due to the fact that Roman sentiment was hostile towards Christianity at this particular time, the emperor found out that the one group of people that he could blame for this crime were the Christians. And not only that, within the Roman city, two of the quarters that weren't even touched by fire were quarters in which Christians lived. And so therefore, he convinced the world, therefore, these Christians must have set the fire because you know what I'm saying, they're the only ones that didn't get touched by it. A fierce persecution was launched by him against the Christians in Rome, and let me just say this, it was vicious. A guy named Tacitus, who was an historian at this time, preserved the event, and he wrote this. So, to get rid of this rumor, Nero set up as culprits and punished with the utmost refinement of cruelty, a class hated for their abominations, who are commonly called Christians. Christus, from whom their name is derived, was executed at the hands of the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. Checked for a moment, this pernicious superstition again broke out, but not only in Judea, but the source of evil, but even in Rome. Accordingly, arrest was first made of those who confessed Christ. Then on their evidence, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much on the charge of arson as because of their hatred for the human race. Besides being put to death, they were made to serve as objects of amusement. They were clothed in the hides of beasts and torn to death by dogs. Others were crucified. Others set on fire to serve to illuminate the night when daylight failed. In fact, this happened inside of his garden. Nero had thrown open his grounds for the display and was putting on a show in the circus where he mingled with people in the dress of a charioteer or drove about in his chariot. All this gave rise to the feeling of pity, even towards men whose guilt merited the most exemplary punishment, for it was felt they were being destroyed, not for the public good, but to gratify the cruelty of an individual. So what about Barack Obama and Donald Trump? I think in the back of our heads, we like to look at this and think, this terrible time must have been awful, but let me say this to you. I think every opportunity the church has is an opportunity to display who Jesus Christ is. I think in that, no doubt, that there's this idea that governors should be these ones that are sent to punish and these ones who are sent to praise those who do good. That's what they're supposed to do. But sometimes everything gets lined up against you. Sometimes these governors, these leaders, everything begins to get lined up against you. And I do feel right now, living in the United States, things feel like they're getting lined up against the church. Now, are we going to sit there and go, oh no, what are we going to do? Or are we going to go opportunity? See, coming out of this opportunity, as awful as it was that was going on in that particular time, is that we had now the church that began to speak into this. A vacuum got created. They watched these people die for no reason at all. And suddenly, they begin to ask the question for the hope that's inside of them. What would cause people to want to go to their deaths? And they begin to ask that question. And Christianity then began to spread like wildfire throughout the city of Rome. It was an opportunity. So what about Barack Obama? I think in hindsight, based on this text, it seems that the church missed a phenomenal opportunity during the presidency of Barack Obama. It seemed as if cultural Christianity, I don't know if you felt this way, was just mad about everything. Did you feel that way? We were just angry. The church joined, I think, this is never-ending chorus of detractors that we should have submitted, but dang it, we didn't feel like it. We were angry because of taxes. We were frustrated because of immigration. We were up in arms with healthcare. We were belligerent over government spending, and it's not as if the church shouldn't speak into those things. Scripture speaks to all of life. But then there was just this, I would say, and I wrote it this way, cacophony of pugnacious clamor. In other words, we started to sound like Charlie Brown's parents. As if God somehow wasn't on his throne. Now, what the problem with that is, though, is that is not according to now the Lord. That's according to me and what I determine is my rights and what I want. And then all of a sudden, when we were supposed to stand on major issues like abortion, like sexuality, like gender dysphoria, nobody listened to us because we were just, wah, 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 wah. It was an opportunity that we missed. Sometimes the church needs to shut up. I think that's what he's saying here. There's a time where the church just submits. There's a time where we gain back our voice and our credibility. It's a time that we listen to the story of God again and the truths of Scripture, and we are no longer then perceived as bitter and angry like we are now, seeking to diminish humanity like we are to do now. But instead, no, we become now the people like E.F. Hutton, and those of you that are younger, ask your grandparents, E.F. Hutton, that when they speak, people listen. I think the church needs to learn again when to speak and when not to. We need to learn to submit. Again, not that we don't have things to say. I don't like taxes. I don't like the way we spend. I like my gun. It's a BB gun. But we need to learn what it means to submit according to the Lord. Well, not only then do you hear then about Barack Obama, but what about Donald Trump? I was listening the other day. I think he's on the edge of Satanhood. I didn't realize he was so bad. Now, the church, it's interesting about that, is that when he came into power, there was probably a man that was more in line with cultural Christianity than, there was no man more than like him between him and Hillary Clinton. But what I saw the church do that was so interesting is all the things that we were so angry about with Bill Clinton, what did we do? We looked the other way when it came to Trump. We really didn't want somebody that was in front of us that was going to lead with moral authority, but a man who would give us the goodies that we lost underneath of Barack Obama. We wanted a man that would restore power to our cultural bent. We made arguments like, well, at least he'll put the people in power that we want in power. And then we were flummoxed when people then somehow on the other side of the argument started looking at Donald Trump like he was an evil, awful guy. And we're like, what's wrong? And they were just acting like we were with Barack Obama. There were many things to appreciate about who he is as a president. And I love so many of the things that he's doing. But I'll tell you what, I think the church is missing our opportunity to have a voice because sometimes we're supposed to shut up, but sometimes we're supposed to speak. Sometimes we are supposed to call sin, sin, and evil, evil. I think one of the most disheartening things when you study back through the history of the church is the rise of Hitler to power inside of Germany. And I am not saying Donald Trump is Hitler, please. Don't even go here with that. Okay, I probably shouldn't use this illustration, but... Is the church, the problem wasn't that the church wasn't existing. The problem was the church didn't speak out. We sat by, and instead of calling evil, evil, we started to call evil good, all for our own comfort. So why would we do this? Why is it that we would even think about doing this? Now look at this. This platform of submission to those in leadership over us, those that are placed over us by God, according to Romans 14, this is the will of God to act this way. This is the way God's designed us. But God, why would you do that? That doesn't make any sense. Why would we submit even to evil, awful people like Nero? He says that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. I think this is what happened in Rome after the persecution of the Christians. They were sitting there being persecuted by this evil man, Nero. And I think at first everybody's like, yeah, let's go get the Christians. But then after a while they realized that these Christians weren't such bad people after all. They weren't as evil as Nero had talked them. Pity began to be placed upon them. And the moment that there was pity, it created a vacuum of silence. And into this vacuum of silence stepped the church to begin to tell them, this is why we would face those beasts. This is why we would be burned alive in a garden. This is why this would happen, because of the hope that we have, not in this world or what this world has to offer, but our hope in Jesus Christ and his eternal kingdom to come. That's why we do what we do. But the church has to know when to shut up, and we also need to know when to speak. There's a place for both. And he says in that now to create, know, this bent and this place of silence so that we can tell and proclaim the answer for the hope that's found within us. Okay, so how do I do that, Todd? Well, in 2:16, he's going to tell us, he says, this is how you do this. The way in which now you're going to do this is live as people who are free. The key idea of living as those who are people of free is everything I just said about you. All of you in this room as followers of Jesus Christ, you are no longer under sin. You are no longer slaves to sin. You're no longer slaves to the world and this system. You're no longer a slave to the evil one. You now instead, if you look at the very end of it, are servants of God. You are completely different. So what do we need to do? We need to remind ourselves over and over again, who we are. We are sons and daughters of the King Most High. We are not slaves to this world and its system. We are slaves to God. We're different. We need to remind each other what this freedom entails. I don't know when's the last time you looked at somebody that you love, and this freedom that entails is you no longer have to live under sin. You no longer have to cave into it. You can be a different human being because of the power of the Holy Spirit inside of you in the work of Jesus. You now have this freedom that one day you will be set free from this world and its system. You are different. But he says in there, even though you're different, not to use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Now, this one is so crucial to us. We need to know our story, because the problem is that when we don't know our story that we're a part of, we will quickly begin to put other people's stories on top of us and we'll add to it. And then we'll even begin to act like somehow this is a Christian story. In the early United States, there was this idea that was placed in front of the people, which was manifest destiny. In other words, just like Israel was supposed to take over the land, the United States, in some type of a religious way, was supposed to take over the land. Our manifest destiny took us to the ends of from coast to coast, and we proclaimed that somehow God had given us this. And I'll tell you what, I've read this thing over and over and over again, and it doesn't say anything about manifest destiny. In the midst of it, we enslaved hundreds of thousands of people from another continent to help build this thing. We then begin to maraud ourselves through this country, killing hundreds of thousands of those that are native to this place, all under the name of God. We replaced a story with a wrong story. Now, I love the country I'm a part of, but I think sometimes we have to be honest as Christians. We can forget that we can begin to use our freedom as a cover-up for evil. Now, the beauty of who all of you are is you are living as servants of God. Today, I was thinking about this before I spoke. I knew I was going to be calling us to submission, and I know some of you are going to leave going, that Todd, he doesn't know what he's talking about, and that's fine. You're probably right sometimes. But I don't want you to miss this last part of it. You can leave here today, and maybe you can look at me and say, you know, I don't really like that. But the last one, I don't think we can get away from. We are servants of God. That's a huge statement. It's this Greek word douloi, which literally means slaves. On one end is one side of it that we're to fear him. He's God. I was just sitting there thinking, this God, I don't know when the last time you looked around at this world that we lived in and watched as waves pounded their way in, and as they begin and they hit the shore, do you realize that there's one being in all of creation that says, thus far and no more, and that's God. There's one God who created this world in such a way that he's separated the expanse to create now a literal shell around the world that protects us from sun rays and all these different things that forms an atmosphere that so that we can breathe oxygen. He's the one that did it. Who does that? No one else. Who's the one that put every star into place and called it by name? The star registry. God. Who's the one that holds everything together by the power of his word? God. We are servants of him. I don't think we sit under the weight sometimes of the awesomeness and the power and the sheer even terror of this God who spun this universe into existence and stars that burn on the outside at 250,000 degrees Fahrenheit and on the inside in the millions of degrees. It's huge. And yet on another level, because of the work of Jesus Christ, he's also called our dad. He's not just anybody. He's our father, our daddy. And I would say this. If our father and daddy, who created everything, asks us to do anything, we say, yes, sir. Now, what we're going to be doing is looking at not only government this week, but we're going to apply it out to our vocations next week, our bosses and our employees. We're going to apply it out in regards to marriage, and the last one we're going to look at is suffering. But my heart and my joy for you today is that you would leave here as people excited to go display Jesus Christ to the world by showing the world what Jesus' submission looked like while he was on here on earth. May you all go and be that church today. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your word. Father, would you allow us to be a church that understands submission, that understands it from the standpoint that we submit to you wholeheartedly, that we find joy in it, that we find contentment in it, that we find satisfaction in it. And then, Father, would you send us out to now be Jesus Christ? Would we be those that submit so that others might know Jesus Christ? Would we be the church that knows when to shut up? Would we be the church that knows when to speak? But would we be the church most importantly that represents Jesus Christ in your precious name?